course, where I realized we wasn't supposed to have done that. Went up there and changed the slides where we're going to do it, and then we didn't do it that way. Yeah, that's right. Keep you on your toes. Luke chapter 22. Going to be looking at verses 31 to 38. You see, I've entitled the message, Sifters and Swords. Our text this morning covers two things that seemingly are just on the verge of being unrelated, but they're not, but they're just different. And so we're going to look at both of them. First one has to do with sifting. The second one has to do with swords. So let's read our text. Luke chapter 22, verses 31 to 38. The Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith fail not. When you are converted, or when you return, strengthen your brethren. And he said unto him, Lord, I am ready to go with thee, both unto prison and to death. And he said, I tell you, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before that thou hast thrice denied that you know me. That's the first part, and then the second part. And he said unto them, when I sent you without purse and scrip and shoes, did you lack anything? And they said, nothing. It wasn't that they said nothing. They did say something. What they said was nothing. Everybody follow that? And he said unto them, but now he that hath the purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip. And he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say unto you that this that is written must yet be accomplished in me. Here's what was written. It comes from Isaiah 53. He was reckoned among the transgressors. And Jesus continues his statement, for the things concerning me have an end. And they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords. And he said unto them, it is enough. The verse that talks about Jesus denying, or Peter denying Jesus three times, is found in all four Gospels. So I went back and looked at the surrounding context of each of those. And you see, I put it in a chart on the first page there. Matthew 26 is where it's found in Matthew, Mark 14, our text here in Luke 22, and then in John 13. And if you look at these things, if you look at them vertically, you can see that Matthew and Mark are basically almost identical. They cover the same information, and there's not anything that one of them covers that the other one doesn't, but they're there. Our passage in Luke, the comments that Jesus made about Satan desiring to have Peter sift him as wheat is found only in Luke, so we're reading something today that's only found in this gospel. And then in John 13, you have the context of all of this discussion a little bit, and that's pretty well it except for the verse about the prediction of the cock crowing. So what I've attempted to do, or want to attempt to do this morning, on this first page in the chart, is kind of put them in perspective, or put them in the order in which they could have occurred. You know, in other words, to merge all four of these passages together and put them in a line of how they would go to harmonize the gospel and such. Now, this, what I'm going to suggest to you is the order of merging these things and harmonizing these things is not the only possible way that it could be done. But to me, it seems the most likely. And I want to begin by reading in John chapter 13, the context in which this begins. John chapter 13, I'm going to begin reading in verse 33 and read a few verses. Actually, I'm going to begin in verse 31. It says, therefore, when he was gone out, Jesus said, and that was Judas Iscariot. When he was gone out, Jesus says this, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God be glorified in him, God shall also glorify him in himself, and shall straightway glorify him." Little children, here he calls his disciples, "Little children, yet a little while I am with you. You will seek me, and as I said unto the Jews, where I go, you cannot come. So now I say to you, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another, as I have loved you, that you love also one another. By this will all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another." Now these chapters in the book of John are from about 13 through 17 or 18, are the most intimate chapters and words of Jesus, I believe, by far in the New Testament. It's an interaction between him and his disciples in the last day or two of his life, and it's just a precious, intimate time that he has with them. And in the midst of that, he tells them, he says, "Where I'm going, you cannot come." And Peter asks him, "Where are you going?" And Jesus repeats, "Where I go now, you cannot follow, but you'll follow me later." And Peter asks him, "Why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." Now Peter adds this last sentence, and apparently Peter is desperately trying to harmonize all these statements of Jesus in his mind. And perhaps he's thinking, man, there's trouble ahead. I mean, Jesus has repeatedly warned them that things are fixing to get rough, that he's going to die and be buried and raised again the third day, and it's every time it's went over the top of their head. We've seen that over and over again. Now, I don't know if Peter, you know, is kind of getting this sense of, you know, "I've heard some of this before. You know, where are you going?" He says, "Why can't I go with you now? I'll lay down my life for you." Then I think we get to the part where Jesus tells them, "All of you will be offended by me when? This night." Things are getting close. We've been talking about that for several weeks. The end is near. And Jesus tells them, "All of you will be offended by me this night." All of you, and he quotes from Zechariah 13, verse 7, "For it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered." In that Old Testament reference that Jesus brings forward to apply to him right now, who is the shepherd that's going to be smited, or smoked, or whatever the word is, stricken, smitten? Who is the shepherd? Jesus. It's saying that Jesus is going to be stricken, and who are the sheep that will be scattered? The disciples, right? The disciples will be scattered. He says, all of you are going to be offended because of me this night. Just like you read in the Old Testament, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. That's interesting that in that Old Testament reference, who is the I that is going to smite the shepherd? God. Now, I don't want to read too much into that. I don't know if Jesus is intending on having a full-blown discourse on Zechariah to figure this out, but in the context of that, it is God who is smiting the shepherd. And in a very real sense, it is God who is smiting his son. All right? So, Jesus tells them, all of you are going to be offended by me this night. And then in verse, the two red ones there, one in verse 32 and one in 28, you see, he says, Jesus says, "After I am risen, I will go before you into Galilee." And then Peter again makes this assertion. He says, all of them may be offended, but not me. Jesus said, all of you will be offended. Peter says, maybe all of them except one. That's me. I will never be offended by you. Not me. And then Jesus says, Simon. Peter's old name. Simon. Satan has desired to have you, to sift you as wheat. Any of you folks, everybody knows what a sifter is, don't you? Anybody ever still use a sifter in cooking? All right. I remember when I was a little boy, I don't know how old, 5 to 7 years old, I guess, going through the kitchen one day, my mother had this sifter, has a handle on it, and you put stuff in it, and then you turn it or do it like this, or I think this one, you turn it completely over, over and over and over. And it looked fun, and I wanted to do it. And so she let me do it, and I did it several times over the next 2 or 3 years or whatever. She'd put flour in it, if I remember right, just a little bit of salt and a little bit of baking soda or baking powder or something else in there with it, and then sift it up. And for a 5 or 7 year old kid, or at least for this one, it's sort of like, you know, somebody asking you, can you pat your stomach and rub your head at the same time? Or the other way around, whatever I said. I don't remember what I said now. And you know how you kind of get messed up every once in a while? That was kind of like me with the sifter. You know, I would have occasion where I would hold it still and then crank it, and then I'd want to hold the handle still and shake the sifter, and it took me a little while to get the hang of it. But sifting, it says Satan wants to, desires to have you that he might sift you like wheat. And how they sifted wheat in those days was, they had 2 or 3 different methods of doing it, but the object was to get the chaff off of the kernel of wheat, off of the wheat grain, or the kernel of it, and separate them, because you can't eat the chaff. Your body won't digest the chaff, so you're going to get rid of it. And, you know, a big operator had an elaborate setup that they would do that with. But for a small farmer, you know, he might would have a little more like he was panning for gold or something. They have a screen deal where he shook it back and forth. They may throw it up in the air and hopefully the wind on a windy day, so the wind would carry off the chaff. They would thresh it first. They would rub it together somehow or walk on it or do something to break that chaff loose, the husk loose from the grain, and then they've got to separate them. So that was what he's saying. Satan has desired to have you that he might just sift your life in that manner. Just rough you up, destroy your life, just like you would be for him, your life is just like wheat that you would sift. But he says, I have prayed for you. And when you return, strengthen your brethren. He tells that to Peter. Now, they say that when it says, I will sift you as wheat, that word you there is plural. And he's probably referring to all 11 of the disciples. And while that may be the case, it certainly happened to them, but he's honing in on Peter. Honing in on Peter. It may apply to all of them, but he's honing in on Peter. So he tells Peter this, and Peter again comes out with this, I would rather go to prison. I'm ready to go to prison. I'm ready to die with you. Then Jesus tells him, before the cock crows, you'll deny me 3 times. And Peter, again, says, I may die with you, but I will never deny you. At this point, the rest of the disciples chime in and say the same thing. Me neither. What he said. We won't deny you. Now, I'll chase a rabbit just for a second. How many of you are aware that in one of the Gospels, Jesus' words are this, before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times. How many of you knew that? All right, several of you. If I knew that, I forgot it. I got reacquainted with it the past couple of weeks. The book of Mark, Jesus says, before the cock crows twice, you'll deny me three times. And read on through the book of Mark, he denies him the first time, it says, and the cock crowed. Then you go on through the second time and the third time, and the cock crows again. The rest of them, he just says it once, and it's only recorded that it happens once. So, we're going to spend just a moment talking about this supposedly contradiction. And I'm not going to, there's three or four ways to explain that and do it justice to some extent. Some of them it's a little hard to see. But I just want to tell you a couple things. First of all, these two statements are not contradictory. They are complementary. All right? Now, here's the deal. What we hear when we say before the cock crows, here's what we hear. Before the cock crows at all, right? Before the cock crows at all, you'll deny me three times. Doesn't say that. It says before the cock crows, you'll deny me three times. Now you might say, well, am I stretching it a little bit? It's obviously implied. Maybe. Here's another thing to consider, is that in every case, in one of them, I think it's Mark, it doesn't say immediately, but in three of the four Gospels, it says when Peter denied him that third time, it said immediately the cock crowed. Okay? So the idea very well may could be, and this I think this is the answer, the idea may very well be that he's talking about when this cock crows this time, you'll have denied me three times. And the cock that is designed to crow that third time is going to crow immediately when he denies him the third time. That cock, that crowing is what he's talking about. Before that cock crows, you'll deny me three times. Now, if you want to read all of the details of all that, a good place to do that is at Answers in Genesis, which y'all are familiar with, that we support. You can go there, look on their website. They've got a whole section on biblical contradictions. Or you can look up on their website one of their speakers named Bodie Hodge, B-O-D-I-E Hodge. He's the one that wrote the article with that. Anyway, I want to bring that out because it is there, and it makes you wonder, doesn't it? All right. Second page, we're going to start looking at this one. First of all, you see the headings for number two and number three go together. What Satan means for evil, God means to use for good. Where at in the Bible is there something similar to that said? Joseph. Joseph is a story back in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, certainly the book of Joseph. The book of Genesis where Joseph is sold by his brothers, and he ends up in Egypt, and later on they get reunited, and his brothers are afraid to let him know who they are because they think he's got it in for them. And Joseph makes this comment, what you meant for evil, by selling me into slavery, God meant for good, because he sent me ahead to prepare for this day so that you would be supplied for, not just you, but the nation of Egypt as well. Now, there is something in that statement that you don't need to miss. And with Joseph or with mine, what God meant or what Satan meant for evil, or what Joseph's brothers meant for evil. God meant for good. key word there is meant. God meant it for good. Now that clearly implies that God knows about it beforehand. And God is, and I guess I could use this word, passively allowing that to happen in order to accomplish the good that God intends to do with the evil that is done. Everybody following that? God meant it. God meant the evil that your brothers did. God meant the evil that Satan wants to accomplish, to do. God meant it for good. God lets the evil happen, using it to accomplish the good that he wants to accomplish. So let's look through it. What Satan means for evil. This or what Satan has desired to have you, it says. You see, I've got some of the different translations the way it's worded. King James says, Satan has desired to have you. The NIV, the Old American Standard Version, and the New King James says, Satan has asked for you that he might sift you as wheat. The New American Standard says, Satan demanded permission. Now, those almost seem like opposites, don't they? Satan demands permission, or in the Revised Standard or the English Standard Version, just says demanded. Satan demanded. If you look in the New American Standard, probably you'll see that word permission in italics, which means it was not in the, it was supplied to make more sense of the sentence. All right? Now, what is this idea of Satan asking that he might sift Peter as wheat? Who's he asking? God. What other incident in the Bible does this remind you of? Job. Satan came before God and asked God for permission to afflict Job. Right? We know the story. God brings the subject up. He asked Satan, where have you been? He says, going to and fro in the earth. And God asked Satan, have you noticed my servant Job? And Satan says, take away all the junk from him, or all the, not junk, all the stuff from him. He'll curse you to your face. The only reason he follows you and worships you is because of all the goodies you give him. He's rich. You've made him rich. Who wouldn't love you? Take it away and see what happens. Satan has desired to have Job that he might sift him as wheat. We know the rest of the story. What was Satan trying to prove in the book of Job? That the only reason Job worshiped God was because of all the material benefits and comforts that God gave to him, right? What about our text? What is Satan trying to accomplish by asking permission to sift Peter? To prove to God that Peter can't stand up to the hard stuff, right? Do we know when this sifting took place? Okay, I assume, as probably you do as well, that it takes place with those three denials. That those are closely linked to the passage right here, and we tend to think this is when Satan wants to sift him. This is the occasion where this happens, where it takes place. Now, let's think about those denials for a minute. And we're not going to spend a lot of time here because in a couple weeks we'll get to that passage in the book of Luke, so I don't want to spend a whole lot of time here. But think about this. They come and get Jesus. He's at the house of the high priest. And they're questioning him, and et cetera, et cetera. Peter follows far off, it says. So they're there. Peter's around the fire, and I think the servant girl comes up and says, hey, I think this guy was with Jesus. And Peter says, not me. I don't know what you're talking about. That's one. A little while later, and these three incidents don't just happen boom, boom, boom. They're over probably at least an hour or two, and probably more. But they're the second time, another, I think it's a girl again, a servant of some sort, comes up and says, hey, this guy was with him. And this time Peter denies him a little more, with a little agitation and with an oath. I swear to God, I don't know the man. You hear that? Swearing to something, and it's always, when you swear, it's always calling upon God to be a witness for you that what you're saying is true. Swearing always has punitive damages, sanctions, if you're found to be lying. We don't look at those words that way, but that's what they mean. So I swear I don't know the guy. A little while later, over an hour or two, I think between the second and the third, someone comes along and says, hey, this guy's there because his speech gives him away. He talks like them. Now, apparently, Peter's running his mouth at the fire talking about something. There's something there that they hear him, the way he talks, that says, this is one of them. And Peter then begins to curse and to swear and to curse, say, I don't know the guy. And at that point, there are five things that although they happen consecutively, they almost happen simultaneously. Peter denies that he knows him the third time. The cock crows. Immediately it says the cock crowed. Then Jesus looks at Peter, and I'm convinced this means that their eyes meet. He looks them right in the face, right in the eyes, and Peter's looking at Jesus in the eyes. Fourthly, Peter remembers what Jesus had said. And fifthly, Peter goes out and weeps bitterly. I wonder if he could get away from the fire and off in the darkness before he began to weep. There's a little four-lined poem that I want to read you. I don't know who wrote this. It reads as if it was a Scottish person or an Australian or something like that. But it goes like this. And as I read this, think of that scene where Peter and Jesus are looking at one another. The poem says this: I think I'd sooner frizzle up in the flames of a burning hell than stand and look into his face and hear him say, well, can you see that? Their eyes meet, and it's as if Jesus is looking at Peter, having heard the denial and heard the cock crow, and Jesus is looking into Peter's face, looking him in the eye, saying, well, he doesn't condemn him, but Peter feels condemned. He doesn't say, I told you so, but Peter knows he told him so. I wonder if Peter had had a sword, how close he came to falling upon it. His bitterness, his shame was so great of failing to do, not just to do what he said he would do, but failing to follow a man and his Lord that he loves. However, what Satan means for evil, God meant for good. Now here is a prediction. And a prediction is a statement of what will be before it is. We use a prediction as in a little lighter sense than that, I guess. We use it as if a prediction is a statement of what we're guessing it will be. All right, we're not guessing here. Jesus is not guessing. What Satan meant for evil, God meant for good. This is not a guess. This is not a hope so. It's not a thing that we're going to see if this really takes place. God meant it for good. And it's an instruction. When the prediction is fulfilled. Jesus doesn't say Satan desired to have you for to sift you as wheat, but God meant it for good. Or he says, when you return. When you return from what? The sifting. When you return from this turmoil or all of whatever it is that Satan's going to dump on you. When you return from this deep, deep shame and sorrow and guilt. When you return, strengthen your brothers. I've got a statement here. Jesus' prayer is not like ours. Jesus said, I have prayed for you. He is not praying, hoping that Peter's faith will not fail. He is praying so that Peter's faith will not fail. There's a world of difference there, isn't there? Our prayers for people that we desperately want to see God answer, at least mine are, I pray for them for whatever the circumstances may be, but when I say amen and get up and go on about my way, am I sure that that's going to happen? No. Jesus' prayers were used so that Peter's faith would not fail. God's not going to have to, after Peter gets out of wherever he goes to weep bitterly, God's not going to have to pick up the tormented pieces and the shattered life or whatever's left of Peter's life and see what he can salvage out of Peter. No. Peter will come back a different and a stronger person because of the sifting that Satan tried to use to destroy. I don't say this scornfully, but there is a sense in which Satan is nothing but God's lackey. Satan will do whatever God tells him to do. I doubt if Satan knew what was going to happen. He thought he was going to be able to destroy Peter. But God used his efforts, his best efforts to destroy Peter, God used it to strengthen Peter, not weaken him. You can keep this incident in your mind about Peter's denials and flip over to 40 days later or so in the book of Acts and read the first 12 chapters. You will see a different Peter. Vastly different Peter. A bolder Peter. You can go on another 20 or 30 years later and read the book of 1 Peter and 2 Peter and see a man who is encouraging people who are walking through trials, who are suffering for the cause of Christ, and encouraging them to stand fast. So there's our first three or four verses. The sifter. Then we come to the second one, the sword. Number four says, back then, and these verses are the comments from, or the headings for four and five go together. Back then I sent you out empty-handed, but now. All right? Back then I sent you out empty-handed. Verse 35, Jesus asks him, when I sent you out without purse and scrip and shoes, when did Jesus do that? You can see, I think I got the references there, if I can see them in Luke chapter 9, verses 1 to 6. You remember the account? Jesus told them, I'll send you out. Don't carry your purse. Don't carry your shoes. Don't carry your backpack. Don't carry anything you might need. Just go. And you come to a village, and someone will let you in their house, and you stay there. If they don't like you and they run you off, they turn against you, then leave. Dust your soles of your feet off as you leave the town and go somewhere else. What is Jesus doing this for? What is Jesus trying to accomplish by sending them out empty and without anything, any preparation? What do you think? Trust. I've heard of trust two or three times. Trusting God to provide for their needs. All right, I think that is probably it. There may be other things, but that seems to be the big one. That we're going to see if God, I'll show you that God will provide for your needs. And they did that. And now, ever how much time has passed later, a year or so later, Jesus asked them, how did that go? When I sent you out, were your needs met? Did you lack anything? They said no. Didn't lack a thing. Nothing. And Jesus adds this word, but. Have you ever had a conversation with somebody and they're telling you, man, this is really good, this is really good, this is really good, and what are you waiting on? But. Waiting on but. They got to kind of butter you up. And then they're going to tear you down. All right? You lack nothing but. And now you know something different is coming. But. That word almost always contrasts what was before with what's after. But now. Things are different. And what is different? What does he say is different? He says, now he who has a purse, let him take it. Likewise, his scrip. That's a bag that you put your supplies in. It's not a prescription to get some medicine at the drugstore. And he that hath no sword, now notice this, let him sell some of his clothes and buy him one. Buy a sword. It's a good thing if January 6th committee had heard Jesus say this. He'd been convicted, wouldn't he? He would be off the ballot every state. Sell some of your clothes and buy a sword. If Donald Trump had said, sell something and buy a gun, that'd have been it, wouldn't it? Jesus says, sell some of your clothes and buy a gun, or buy a sword. Maybe a gun, I don't know. Buy a sword. Take some money with you. Take your clothes with you. Take some food with you. Take preparations. Have them handy. Now, why is Jesus telling them that at this point? Bad times are coming. Bad times are coming. That's it. All right? Now, I'm not satisfied that I know exactly what all is going on here. But then that may be the whole point is bad times are coming. Things are fixing to get rough. Jesus quotes a verse in there, verse 37, "For I say to you that this that is written must yet be accomplished in me." Now Jesus quotes a portion of Isaiah 53, where it says, he was reckoned among the transgressors. So he was found guilty, even though it was a false guilt. He was found guilty of a crime, and he was taken. And so the disciples are about to be alone. I think that at least this is what he's saying. Things are about to get rough. Things are escalating fast. This night, before this night is over, all of you are going to be offended by me. Peter's going to deny me three times. Be ready. Don't get caught off guard by a sword or a gun. The disciples then say, "Lord, behold, here are two swords." Two swords. How many of them is it? 11. 11 guys, two swords. Would you want one of them? I think one of them ought to be, I'll hang on to one of them. Y'all can fight over the other one. We got two swords. What does Jesus say? That's enough. Now, what does that mean? I have read someone who explained that this way, that the disciples weren't getting his message by the buying and the not having your stuff and having your stuff, all this kind of stuff. They just weren't getting his point. And Jesus, when he said it is enough, he was really just saying what we would use these words, just forget it. Whatever. I don't believe that. I don't think that's it. For probably the main reason I don't think that's it is because I have a hard time seeing Jesus being so condescending, especially at this point in these guys' lives. Someone else has suggested that Jesus is saying, okay, that's good enough. Discussion's over. We're through with that. We're moving on. And they get up and they go to Gethsemane. Okay? So we've got other things to do. Got to go do them. That kind of thing. I just don't know. I don't know what he means by that. But I do think that overall, in this second part, the general message is things are about to get very ugly. You're going to be running for your life. You're going to be hiding. You're going to be people looking for you just like they are looking for me. They'll want to kill you just like they are going to kill me. All of these kind of things is wrapped up in what Jesus is saying here. Now, right at the end, three or four things I want you to consider from this passage this morning. The first one is this, that you're perceived, and I mean perceived by you primarily, your perceived strong traits may well be your most vulnerable. Of all the things that Peter thought were his weaknesses, following Christ wasn't one of them. He was sure he would follow Christ. Peter was sure he was ready to die for Jesus. Peter is sure he would never deny him. But he did. Be careful that the areas in which you think you stand, says in the book of Romans, doesn't it? Man who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. The areas in which you think you're least likely to fail Christ may make you more vulnerable in those areas. The second one is this. Sinful betrayal is most often accompanied by deep, deep shame and guilt. Now notice I put an adjective in front of this betrayal. Sinful betrayal. Is there other kind of betrayal besides sinful betrayal? I think so. I think if I infiltrate a enemy of the United States in a war or something, and I infiltrate their camp or whatever the case may be for the sole purpose of gaining their trust, and then I betray them to my own country, I don't look at that as sinful betrayal. Betrayal, sinful betrayal, is betrayal that you have no business carrying out. Betrayal of your spouse. Betrayal of your God. Betrayal of your children, your parents, your church, whatever the case may be. The third one, a person may act with disloyalty without being disloyal at heart. Now we could ask the question, well, was Peter disloyal at this point? Yes. This incident, in this incident, Peter was disloyal. But in his heart, in the deepest recesses of his soul, he was not a disloyal person. You can say that this way, you can see it, the point a little easier. A person can be drunk without being a drunk. Right? And I think that's the case here. Peter could fail in this area without that being a characteristic of his life. And the last one. God very well may have already planned to use your failures to build his church. God may have already planned. Two good words there. Two important words. Already planned to use your failures, to use my failures to build his church. We'll continue these last days of Christ next week. Let's pray.